Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to another one of our drop-in or call-in discussion groups. This week, we're going to be talking about the story of Little Kate from Pathways to Pain Relief. As always, this is a peer book group, essentially. We can't offer medical advice. If you need it, go see a licensed medical or mental health professional. To see our full disclaimer, you can go to tmswiki.org. It's at the bottom of the page. If you have any questions, just contact one of us, about how to find the disclaimer. My co-hosts today are Bruce MC from our forum and our chat room, as well as Eric Watson, also from our forum and our chat room, and possibly later on we will be joined by Enjoy. So at this point, I'm going to hand it off to Bruce MC, who's going to introduce the story and tell us his thoughts on it.
The subject of our book discussion today is the story of Little Kate in Anderson and Summers' Pathway to Pain Relief, and it's entitled Little Kate's Journey. Kate, who is now at the start of the session with Dr. Anderson, was aged 40, and she came in for a focused consultation after having met Dr. Sarno, who referred her to Dr. Anderson. By the time we met, she was pain-free most of the time, but she wanted additional help to reduce the pain even further. At the current time, she was living abroad with her husband, Rick, I believe, who'd received a job overseas, and so she was just back for a limited amount of time to see Dr. Anderson. These were going to be 5 sessions within a 4-day period with, I believe, some follow-ups via Skype. And she had been suffering from back pain now at 40 ever since she was 26. And, of course, she'd gone through the full retinue of traditional physical therapy and alternative therapy, too. She mentions having spent thousands of dollars. She tells Dr. Anderson that I've been consumed with my back pain for most of my adult life and up until I saw Dr. Sarno last January. But her journal entries, the ones that she provided to Dr. Anderson, chronicle a really poignant childhood, her early childhood and young adulthood. During her childhood, her mother had become very depressed and turned to religion for help. This coincided with mom having a hysterectomy, which is never explained very well, what the motivations were. This is a question I have. Why did mom become so depressed? Kate was 12, her mother made the first attempt to take her life, which I involved slashing her wrists. That isn't described in much detail, but it left her permanently disabled. And from the time she was 9 until her mother died, I think when she was 12, she no longer had a carefree, happy childhood. And she remembered various instances where her mother had tried to take her life again. One day she came home from school and found her mother laying in bed with plastic bags tied tightly around her head. This must have been a pretty shocking afternoon, I imagine. And at that time, her entire family revolved around her mother's moods, her good days and her bad days. And then finally, when she was 16, her father took her aside after picking her up from school and told her about the tragic news of her mother's death. My father told me my mother's heart simply stopped beating. She had given up the will to live. You know, it gets back to that classic Freudian will to live and the will to death, the eros thanatos dichotomy. And this left Kate, of course, with a lot of questions about how could a mother want to leave behind her children, completely innocent victims, to fend for themselves in such a completely selfish act and waste of life. And she says that her mother died of a broken heart because of the physical mess due to her own foolish attempt on her life. Mutilation, self-mutilation. And this, of course, she also considered Kate considered suicide when her back pain was at its worst, but she always snapped out of it, out of her self-pity, pity, and put her children first. So there was a volte face on Kate's part.
What's a volte face, Bruce?
A reversal, a turn of face in reaction to what her mother had done, and she seems to have been compensating for this all her life. When she met Rick, and then there's more bad news too. Shortly after my mother died, my grandfather died of a tumor, and then her grandmother took her own life. So there's a double suicide behind all of this. And then she starts a business in young adulthood, financed by her parents' mother, her parents' equity, I take it, down at the bank, securing her debt. And this is when her back pain starts, when the business starts to go kerfritz. She had a health club with two partners. And the first 2 years were successful, but shortly after Grandma died, they started having financial problems, and this is when she started having back pain. And throughout all of this, she had a strong sense of responsibility and integrity to keep going. She kept having to teach classes, even when she was hurting. She claimed, I was in with my back and the depression this brought. I had to work. She wanted to honor the financial debt to the bank and my parents, as they had secured our financial debt to the bank by acting as guarantors. Now, this is classic ground for the development of TMS, I would say, the parental connection there and the responsibility, of course, with the troubled childhood, too, at the same time.
If I can interrupt, tell me, like, specifically how do you see that parental connection working and leading to the TMS? Is it obligation and part of her rebelling against that obligation and therefore developing rage, or how does that? Do you see a connection in there, a specific one, or just you that's where you want to look?
I think she had a tremendous sense of responsibility to compensate for what her mother had done being a supermom. And it's very interesting how her mother had the hysterectomy, and then when she tried to conceive after the first child, she had a series of miscarriages, no matter how hard she tried. It's as if there's almost a cross-generational body-mind connection. One trauma to another trauma. Just think about how she had this huge emotional fit when she was pregnant, when Kate was pregnant with her first child. Waiting 3 weeks for the Down syndrome screening test results, quote, was one of the worst times of my life. I was an emotional mess. My body almost shut down. My back went. I had an eye infection and just couldn't stop crying. Now, most people, when they go through the tests for Down syndrome, don't put themselves through this kind of self-torture. She obviously felt she needed to compensate by having a child and rearing it with happily. In contrast to her husband, who had a rather lackadaisical, laissez-faire attitude toward child rearing that Kate couldn't communicate to her. But
right, that was a source of tension between the husband and wife. I remember that now.
Yeah, it was, because she had to be the perfect mom. She had to conceive. A fatal necessity. She couldn't take it a relaxed approach to these things. They had to be a big deal. And at the end of the story, I realized that being married to Rick creates tension for little Kate. This is in the journal that she sends to Dr. Anderson. And yep. There are times when she feels she carries the burden and responsibility, this time for her children, not her mother. I need to learn to nurture little Kate, mother her as I would mother my own children. Her personality is sensitive, similar to my daughter's. I need to predict how she is feeling during uncomfortable moments of confrontation and how she deals with times of sadness and anger. The child is immature and in constant conflict with the Kate of today. She's been carrying this wounded child around with her throughout her adulthood, and as a result has been paying a price with back pain by not attending to those basic needs that were the burden of her tragic history and her family. So to answer your question, and perhaps at that point you could take over.
Sure. Absolutely. Eric, did you want to jump in? I mean, like I said, as we were preparing, I have three ideas of things that I could share. But Eric, did you want to say something?
One of the things at 9 years old, Kate had remembered her mother being depressed and something about a hysterectomy. And then at 12 years old, the mom attempted suicide and it left her disabled. And then as I remember, as Bruce said, at 16 years old, she took her life. See, that hit so home with me because as I was growing up, mom would always, if we went anywhere, say to the skating rink or anything like that, mom would always say she wished she was dead before we got back home. And I was in fear the whole time I was gone. By the time I got back home, hopefully my mama wouldn't be dead. And my mama tried suicide.
That's terrifying.
Can you hear me?
Yes. All right.
My mama tried suicide on three occasions. It's very traumatic when you're that young. It sticks with you. It won't leave. It's your mother. You love her. And for a child, we don't know any other way to look at it other than like little Herbie or little Kate. By the way, my name's Herbert, so I guess y'all know that now. But it really hit home reading all this, and I can understand why she has a lot of repressions, and she talks like, you know, this is what little Kate needs. I think there at the end of the story, she started telling her husband, Rick, what little Kate needed. And she started pampering little Kate in a way. And it was different than the way I went about correcting my issues, but at the same time, I could see why she was doing it real easy. There was a lot of things that hit home. Like the day I came home and I saw my mom had done took a whole bottle of pills. And we hoped she wasn't going to die. The thing about it is when you grow up and you've been through these tragedies, they don't leave. They're a part of your body. They're a part of your mind. They're there. And then at 21, she went on and she started her own company. She went on to move on with her life. I think her back pain actually started then. It had gotten worse at 26, but she was an eager beaver. She was making sure she was going to do her work, and that was me. My back pain started at 15, and no matter what, I was going to work through it. I always had I had to do what I had to do, and I think it turned out to be 25 years that I worked through that. But we can make it, and the answer is in the stories about getting the repressions out. facing them, getting them out, knowing they're there, talking about them like I'm doing right now. I've never talked about this before. I didn't even journal it. So now I'm getting it out, and hopefully other people can bring out some stories too.
Thanks for sharing that, Herbie. That's that was quite powerful. It just it seems like it's such a big deal. I mean, I think I've mentioned before that my own mother died, and I have a book about it. It's called, you know, the Scar That Lasts Forever. So I think it's the wound that lasts forever. So I think it's a powerful thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to realize that a child's primordial fear is abandonment, being abandoned by the mother or a caregiver. And suicide is the ultimate abandonment. And that addresses all of our primal fears as a child, especially when it happens early like that. When it's a recurrence in the family.
One thing which, building on what you said there, one thing which really touched me is when she wrote, as a mother, I find this so hard to comprehend. How could a mother ever want to leave behind her children, completely innocent victims, to fend for themselves in such a completely selfish act and waste of a life? This is her take on it, her personal feelings. I feel so angry and disappointed with her, although I'm happier knowing that she did actually die naturally rather than kill herself. And it's, you know, when I read that, I said, I just tried to imagine the feelings behind it and how she must have felt as she wrote that. She must have felt rejected. You know, my girlfriend is adopted, and, you know, that's a similar sort of pain that happens early on in your life, where your mom actually gives you up. And deep in your mind, when you find that out, you might ask yourself, am I flawed? Is there a reason why my mom gave me up? Similar wound. And I can just say, you know, as I was reading this, it reminded me of that, and, you know, how it must have hurt her that her mom didn't want to stay with her and provide her the love that she needed, didn't care enough. So I saw pain in there, but also kind of the flip side of pain when your parent hurts you is rage. Why did you hurt me? So I can see a lot of the I can see a reservoir of rage beginning to be filled earlier in that situation as she, you know, goes over to her friend's house and they have normal lives, and she goes back to her house and she has to think of, am I going to find my mom with a plastic bag over her head? And I just, that's, I think that, I she must have strong feelings towards her mom.
I knew a guy in high school who was very dependent on his mother, and one day he came home to the house when he was about 18 or 19, and there she was dead in a chair.
Yeah.
And then things started to happen to him. He got drunk one night, and a telephone toll booth wouldn't return his coins, his change. So he revved up his car and slammed into it and knocked it off its moorings.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took him. He wasn't injured, but they put him in the psycho ward at the hospital. And then later on, there was a fire in the house and he got burned, and they put him in the hospital, and there wasn't anything the matter with him, but they put him in the psycho ward. And I lost track of him. But you could tell that one incident, coming home and finding mom dead, led to complete mental instability the rest of his life. I'm sure he had some kind of a bad ending. Those kind of things are quite profound and shocking when you're young. Well, they're shocking any time. But if you have a house that's a haunted house filled with suicide and rumors of suicide, it's got to cast a shadow over your whole life afterwards. as it did Kate.
Well, and you felt that also, like you lived in a haunted house as well, right?
Oh, well, there was always the problem of Papa. I didn't want to bring people into the house because then they would find out about Mom and Dad fighting and how unstable it was. So it was the burden I put on my shoulders.
And even after they passed, though, when you said the haunted house, it just reminded me about how you've talked previously about how your TMS started when you inherited, if I remember correctly, their house.
Been like my entire life, I had been trying to avoid the house.
Yeah.
And I realized now it was like habitual. When I went climbing, I'd get away from it. When I went surfing, I'd get away from it. When I went to grad school, I'd get away from it. When I moved to Palo Alto, it was such a relief to get away from it. When I finally told them to shove it, all of a sudden I had a life and things were really great. But I didn't realize it was back there all the time to clean up. You don't get out of those things. You can have temporary escapes, but unless you do some fundamental homework with those, with yourself and your family, you never really resolve those problems. You could evade them, yes. You can accommodate some measure of normalcy, but if there's always that at the back of your mind,
kind of like what Eric was saying about that, to uncover the repressions.
Yeah, to work through them. You notice too that Kate is a person who cannot say no.
Oh yeah, it's got that perfectionist, that goodest thing.
Yeah. At the gym that she started, she had to work on and do those high step exercises when her body was killing her. And
that was me, brother.
One of the things that one of the items on the list that she gave to Dr. Anderson about things she needed to do was she said, I need to learn to be more direct and assertive with Rick, to say no when I don't want to do something, rather than letting little Kate make the decision and then confronting this decision later on. That's what comes from that bifurcated personality, where you haven't addressed those issues and they have a life of their own that lives on and on in this personality deep inside of you that's different than the face you present to the world. But it's still pulling the strings, too. Interesting.
Yeah. I have an interesting bit kind of building on that I got from Dr. David Clark. but I think that Enjoy wants to say something. Did you want to pipe in?
Oh, hi. I was muted.
Hey, Enjoy.
Well, I don't know. I was thinking about something that was kind of off the topic entirely. So maybe I'll leave that for later. But what I'm thinking about this particular thing is that, when I watch those of you who had these very difficult situations with your parents, like Forrest, your mom dying when you were young, and this poor little Kate, and all this suicide stuff. I mean, it's all very difficult. And it's funny. I'm almost glad that I didn't have anything like that with my parents. They were both alcoholics, and they just simply, they were just a big fat negative zero, if there is such a thing. And so what happened to me is that I cried my entire childhood wishing that I had, some kind of relationship, positive relationship with them, but it just wasn't to be. And so it was 9 when I really decided they were the problem and more than me. And that one. Yeah, well, I had to, because if it was me, then it was just so hopeless. I couldn't deal with it. And it didn't seem quite fair because I didn't see exactly what I was doing besides kid stuff, But then when I was around 10 or 11, and this was really heavy, but I think it was good for me in a way. Is every time they went out the door, I prayed they'd die. I thought, oh, my God, if they'll only die. You know, it'll just, I would be so glad if they died. And I really, really, really meant it, hey? But, of course, yeah. They never died. They always came back. And so, you know, I had to live with that. But, I mean, it was good. Like, there were good things about them, too. There was food on the table and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, it was all right from that point of view. So, in a way, that was kind of a watershed. And after that, I had to get on with being my own person, leading my own life, being independent, and, you know, parents were no longer on the table. And actually, strangely, I grew up, I had a really happy teenagehood because, you know, I just completely blown them off and went through some heavy stuff, as a teen does, but nevertheless pretty good. But then later on when I was married and I had my own kids, I tried to get back in touch with them. Right. And I tried to, you know, trying to, you know, go visit them and I was needing them again. Right. Like I did when I was a little kid, but it didn't work. It didn't work. So finally I blew it off again. And so listening to those of you who had some warm fuzzies in with the tribulations makes me sort of glad I didn't.
Yeah.
Was weird, but you know, it's like there's a silver lining in everything, isn't there?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. That's interesting. It's interesting also that this story is talking about what might be called adverse childhood events. I saw a presentation by Dr. Clark where he reviewed and a very important paper. I think he said this is one of the most important papers on in mind-body medicine of the century. And it's called the Adverse Childhood Experience Study. Researchers went through, he said, probably the most important public health study in our generation. And they categorized seven adverse childhood events or experiences. And it's interesting hearing Enjoy talk about my experiences because, you know, I think everybody when they start to journal, they say, oh, I had a happy childhood. It takes a little while to dig it up. I think it's and then that was kind of how I was feeling. I was like, what do you mean, people? Why are you lumping me in there? I don't get that. So here they are. The first one is physical abuse. The second one is sexual abuse. Third one is psychological abuse, like putting someone down. The next one is substance abuse in the household. Next one is mental.
I got 4 for 4 so far.
Mental illness in the household, and then domestic violence in the household. So,
I've got a set of those.
Okay,
yeah.
7%.
Yeah, I think I hit 3 out of 5.
Well,
I'm entitled, eh? But you know, I wanted to say that one time I was working as a counselor, and I don't have much training, but, you know, I've sort of picked up a lot of stuff. And I was actually working, doing this thing for the Justice Department up here, working with people who were involved in the justice system, and nobody wanted to throw them in jail quite yet, so they sent them to me. And she was so desperately unhappy, and we spent several sessions. I kept poking around because usually you find sexual abuse, you know, it's just that I couldn't find a thing, and she was just adamant. And I actually had to accept that she was raised in a family. There were 7 kids. Her parents were really nice people, right? And she had been so happy when she was a kid that she could not cope with adulthood. Simple as that. She now had a husband, she had a job, she had 3 kids, and she was just absolutely miserable. And I had finally had to accept. I mean, I'm not a therapist, so, you know, maybe I missed something, but I don't think so. You know, it doesn't really matter what happens to you. We seem to be you know, able to screw things up no matter what.
It is amazing the complexity of the psyche. But let me finish. Let me say a little bit more about the study, if I may.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
The core of the analysis from the paper was they compared people who had four or more of these adverse childhood experiences or events versus zero, and said how much more likely are they to have multiple somatic symptoms. And someone who has four or more versus zero of these adverse childhood effects, or ACEs, as they call the acronym, is 2.7 times more likely to have multiple somatic symptoms. So it is absolutely no coincidence that the people on this call would go down this checklist and experience that, because we're the ones with multiple somatic experiences. I think it takes 20 years off your life expectancy. It's what were you saying, Bruce? I have more actually on the thing. I'll come back to it.
To get back to my favorite topic, war. Because it's like an environment that distills these things presents them in a
PTSD.
Pure form. I was reading a study the other day about post-traumatic stress disorder in Vietnam vets, and what was the determinant whether someone was going to come out of combat okay, or whether they were going to be hypervigilant the rest of their life and constantly be self-medicating to try and smooth things out? Well, it seems that you can go through combat and killing other people at close range and come out of it okay if you have not had ACEs in your background. If you go into the Army and are sent out to some killing field, and you already have the beaker half filled with stress from your childhood, then you are the one who is going to succumb to combat fatigue and be sent to the back and then have lifelong problems afterwards. It's like we have a beaker that we fill up. It's like Dr. Sarno says again, that incremental approach to stressors. If you don't have many stressors, then the big stressor comes along and you're not going to be permanently impaired by it. But if you're already halfway there and then you're placed in close combat situations, up close and personal, then you're not going to come out of it all right. You're not going to return to civilian life and be okay.
My bet is, having read a number of studies like those, not in that specific literature, but elsewhere, my bet is that it's about probability. I mean, I think you're just much more likely. There is a statistically significant increase in probability. And I think that's maybe an important thing to mention, because I think that it's empowering to us to know that if we have had those adverse childhood experiences, that it isn't deterministic, that that we do have some control, and that we can that we don't have to get the PTSD, that there is hope in some sense.
And the cure is, as Dr. Sarno says, knowledge.
Yeah.
In the prefrontal cortex, understanding these things is the cure. Is the way to avoid the statistical probability becoming deterministic.
Very interesting.
Yeah, free will.
You know, when you were saying that, and that's something that I've been thinking about a lot on the forum recently, and I am going to tie this into Kate a little bit, but I do want to say that when you were talking about the Vietnam veteran thing and how some people are primed, the thing which it reminded me of was Kate and her health club, and how it was very much, you know, running a small business is a very challenging thing. And what made that too much was, I suspect, the fact that she had those adverse childhood experiences.
Well, that her
I'm hearing a little bit of an echo on my phone, so make sure that no one's using the speakerphone And that everybody is using headsets, if you could. It's something that's always very important. You guys won't notice it, but everybody else who listens to it will, if you're using speakers or speakerphone. So please use headsets or use a regular phone. What were you saying, Bruce?
Well, that her family financed the health club, created that direct connection with her past. And that was why she had to be so good at it. Even when she was hurting, she had to force herself. Well, the finances would do that, but it's still, it's not like the bank. It's like your parents are on the line, and you have to be responsible for them, which makes it much more stressful.
Right.
Yeah, if you default on the bank, you go bankrupt and they run you out of town on a rail, but you default on your parents. Having known people who've done this, the stress of the last year before you go down is just amazing, especially if parents have financed your small business with a mortgage on their house. Yeah, I know people who are still working to pay back their little indiscretion with their small business. It lasts for a long time afterwards.
I'm sure. So she was probably facing that, and that was probably tying in with the priming issue. I want to take. Does anyone mind if I finish up the thing about the ACEs that I got from Dr. Clark?
I'd love
maybe
to
tie
hear
it.
Could you, Forrest? Could you give us a little bit of more information about who Clark is and the name of a book or something? Because it's not working to Google it.
I see. Dr. David Clark, MD, is the author of They Can't Find Anything Wrong. He's a gastroenterologist in Portland, and he sees TMS he's seen many TMSers with gut problems. He's also the current president of the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, which is a 501c3 public charity. I'm on the board of that as well. I'm the president. And its mission is to provide training opportunities for TMS practitioners. And it's done an amazing job of that, I think. We've held two conferences so far, one in LA and one in New York, and now we're setting up some pilot programs for more ongoing trainings. But his book is They Can't Find Anything Wrong. My pleasure. So he talked about the ACEs, and he talked about how if you have more than 4 versus 0, you're 2.7 times as likely to have multiple somatic symptoms. Again, there's no determinism there. You're not infinitely more likely. But 2.7 is a big number. When he talked about what are the effects of the childhood stress, he talked about the primary one being low self-esteem. That if you're given, like in Kate's case, adult responsibilities early on, you're not going to be arousing success. You're not going to be able to keep that family together, so you might feel inadequate. You might say, why couldn't I stop? Why couldn't I have saved my mom? There are various different types of adverse childhood effects, so they all can have different channels. But then in terms of the outcomes, there are some positive outcomes that we know. People with adverse childhood events tend to be reliable and detail-oriented and compassionate, hard worker, like Kate, like many TMSers that we know on the forum. The very first negative outcome that he listed, and he unfortunately listed a bunch, is that we tend to take bad partners. And I think that's something that we've talked about a lot on this podcast. When we've looked at Ellen and we've said, how are these people doing this? One of the main things that Dr. Clark looks at. If you've got these issues in your past, how is that reflected as you maybe replicate chaos from your childhood in adult relationships? It also shows up in addictions, in quick temper, eating disorders. We had someone drop in with an eating disorder in the chat room. Also fibromyalgia she had, self-mutilation, self-sacrifice, these are goodists. And then one thing which we've talked a lot about in this book is an inability to feel emotions. And that's a lot of maybe what Sherman and Anderson work on for in their psychotherapy. In terms of how people get better, he talked about how the key thing was them recognizing that they deserved better. And I saw this in Kate, where what she needed to do was she needed to go to, let's see, I'm getting a little bit of reverb, so I'm just going to mute everyone briefly since I seem to be talking. So she said at a certain point that she deserved better. She learned to stand up to her husband, who wasn't giving her what she needed, and say, hey, how do I, and say, this is what I need. This is what I need from you. And I tie this story and the ACE stuff, I mean, it all ties together, right? So it reminds me a lot of Alan Gordon, how he talks about how important it is to be kind to yourself, to make sure that you get as much as you give in relationships. Again, the relationships are a key thing that he's focusing on. and then he talks about rage. He talks about, you know, how it also leads to rage, and this is key in Dr. Sarno's analysis. We know that it's key in TMS, that it comes from years of learning to suppress emotions. You know, that's what in Pathways to Pain Release, we saw see these case histories learning to unsuppress their emotions. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting how we could see reflections of Dr. Clark's lecture in this story. He encourages.
I think that journal entry that she sent, that Kate sent to Dr. Anderson, about their last session together, addresses a lot of these questions. Quote, I went to my appointment today feeling very tense and emotional. This morning while writing my notes, I went to the bathroom and wept uncontrollably for how I was feeling inside. I wept for the child inside me, little Kate, the child who, at the age of 9, started to lose her childhood following the onset of mom's depression and eventually her attempted suicide and death. This child remains deep within, frightened, abandoned, insecure, introverted, desperately looking for her mother's love. I realize that being married to Rick creates tensions for little Kate, as there are times when she feels she carries the burden and responsibility, this time for her children, not her mother. Transference there. I need to learn to nurture little Kate and mother her as I would my own children. Her personality is similar to my daughter's. I need to predict how she is feeling. I think that's part of the resolution of Kate's symptoms have to do with this caring for the inner child, caring for herself, something she's neglected all her life. Mm-hmm. And that's the solution that Dr. Anderson proposes that seems to be working for her despite the vicarious long-distance nature of the therapist-patient relationship necessarily because of her living in Asia.
Well, and that reminds me so much of what Alan Gordon says when mm-hmm. he talks about, just the parallels here are pretty astounding, I think, when he talks about reparenting. It talks a lot about reparenting. And in terms of how she tries to reparent little Kate in the way that she would reparent her kids, that is a big thing, which I very often hear from Dr. Clark, is... you know, we all think that we had good childhoods. We don't realize how hard it was. But Dr. Clark often says, imagine that someone else, a child that you loved, your niece or your nephew or your own child, had to go through what you went through. How would you feel about that? And, you know, maybe that's a good starting jumping off point for the ISDVP stuff where you would get angry. You know, it's not fair. It's not right. And again, that's where Alan Gordon comes back in. Alan Gordon always says that the first step is developing compassion for your inner child and for the victim of your own inner bully.
I just wanted to say a couple of quick things because we're almost done. Is one is that not all of us think we had a good childhood. That is not
for us.
But the other thing is, and there's someday I would like to talk about the effect of our difficulties on our own children, because I keep hearing over and over and over again, oh, I'm so much better with my own kids. I'm such a wonderful mother, blah, 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 blah. And excuse me, but that's nonsense. Nonsense. I'm not saying that you're not doing all kinds of things better than your parents did. You're doing the exact opposite of them, but you're also bringing to those children your own difficulties. They're absorbing them. And I think that's something that we have to talk about someday, and not just congratulating ourselves about what charming parents we are, because it's just not true. I tried my best to raise my kids well. I really tried my best, and I thought I was wonderful, right? And I wasn't, turns out.
Yeah.
That's a good subject.
It's a great point.
What's that song what's that song lyric? Some things you can't hide when you're crippled inside. The kids can see it. No matter how much you try to be good and perfect, they're going to see what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
Well,
they see things directly and clearly.
But the worst of it is, Bruce, is that they see it and they think it's their fault. They're kids.
Oh,
yes.
Blaming yourself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't
classic
think it's
issue.
You. It's them.
Classic issue. Let's see. So I told you earlier that I had kind of three bits that I had prepared. I covered Dr. Clark and the ACE study. Talked about Alan Gordon and reparenting. Maybe at the end, unless someone else has something, I can do my last little bit.
I'd like to know if she ever came to the conclusion that little Kate's fine now. She can, you know, kind of be one person besides, you know, two.
Yeah, I think that we didn't get to follow that. Dr. Anderson didn't talk about that. Everything happened actually within the space of a couple of weeks. It was just a bunch of intense therapy over 4 days and then maybe an email or two afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Dr. Anderson laments the fact that they didn't have more time together.
Yeah.
I think at the end of each one of these sessions on different patients of Dr. Anderson's, you come away with questions like, with Ellen, why did she marry that abusive guy? That's never really, really cleared up, although you can extrapolate from her history why. But then in Kate's case, I wondered, why did Mom become depressed and try to commit suicide in the first place? There had to be something going on in her family history. And then Grandma turning around and committing suicide, too, after her daughter's death by a broken heart. Well, that's according to Kate's father, too. But did she really commit suicide? And this was a euphemism that the father passed on to little Kate, saying that she died of a broken heart, or did she finally do it?
Right.
And he wanted to shield her from that. Those were some questions I had at the end of the story.
They
weren't really explained, but I guess we can't know everything. We can only see it through the eyes of the therapist and the information provided during the sessions. But there are always these questions, aren't there? There's always more.
Indeed. Indeed. I guess the last thing that I wanted to say, my final bit, is I just thought it was interesting the way that they used the information that they got in the forum. Sometimes I see people who are working to discharge all of their old emotions, and sometimes some of the newer things that I've been reading is if you work too hard at discharging emotions, if you don't do it right, you can actually reinforce those old emotions. So I thought it was interesting that what I saw, Dr. Anderson said, it's She needs to get in touch with her emotions, but I didn't see in the story her re-experiencing the emotions to discharge them. Rather, she was developing a connection with her emotions. This is something that Dr. Sherman talked about in earlier chapters. If you know what it is that you're feeling, if you can articulate those feelings, if you're not alexithymic, then you can develop compassion for the feelings. You can change the feelings. You can change the emotional tone in the presence. In some sense, it's just a form of what Daniel Goleman calls emotional intelligence. It's knowing what your feelings are and knowing how to manage them. Of course, to do that, you have to be able to feel the feelings. But it is about moving on. It is about, and that's, I guess, one of the themes, it is about moving on, and to some degree, yes, she does have a wounded little Kate inside of her, but she's going to take care of that little Kate, and then that will allow the wounded little Kate, perhaps, to step back a little bit and recover a little bit. So I thought that was a nice theme, is that they didn't that I could see Kate moving forward in her life, reimmersing herself in her life and her children and everything, and her marriage and everything that she loved about her life.